Resilient Cyber Podcast brings you conversations from diverse cybersecurity professionals, ranging from executives, subject matter experts, and aspiring entrants. Today's diverse threat landscape requires systems that can withstand a variety of cyber incidents, remaining trustworthy and secure.
Resilient Cyber is sponsored by Acquia, a cybersecurity service, disabled veteran-owned small business that is passionate about enabling innovation and driving secure digital transformation. Acquia believes in guardrails over roadblocks and security as a business and mission enabler. Learn more at acquia.us. That's A-Q-U-I-A.us. Before we start the episode, we want to give a big thank you to our season 4 sponsor, Nucleus Security. Meet Nucleus, the only risk-based vulnerability management platform purpose-built for the world's most complex enterprises. Nucleus takes the mountain of vulnerability data that is produced by your security stack and unifies it into one clean dashboard that helps you make sense of your assets and vulnerabilities. With Nucleus, users get a normalized and deduplicated list of vulnerabilities across network devices, cloud, applications, and more. Next, we layer in risk and vulnerability intelligence from sources like Mandiant to help you prioritize the vulnerabilities that matter most. Ready to see how Nucleus can help improve your vulnerability management program? Head to nucleussec.com today. We want to take a moment to thank one of our Season 5 sponsors, Wiz. Wiz transforms cloud security for customers, including 35% of the Fortune 100, by enabling a new operating model. With Wiz, organizations can democratize security across the development lifecycle, empowering them to build fast and securely. Its cloud-native application protection platform, CNAPP, drives visibility, risk prioritization, and business agility, and is number one based on customer reviews. Find out more at wiz.io.
Thank you for joining the Resilient Cyber Show. My name is Chris Hughes, and today I'm joined by Greg Rasner. Greg, thanks for being here.
Pleasure to be here. Thanks for inviting me.
Yeah, definitely. You and I, we were just joking. We've been chatting for what feels like at least, you know, 2 or 3 years at this point about, you know, software supply chain security, cybersecurity, you know, third-party risk management. It's the first time we've ever actually had a conversation live, so I'm excited to chat with you. But for folks that don't know you and haven't been following you, you know, can you tell us a bit about, you know, who you are, your background, and so on?
Sure. So Gregor Rasner, my current role is as SVP leader for cyber third party risk at Truist Financial Corporation. I've got a well over 20 years experience in IT and cyber security architecture, building up BPOs and offshore centers. Most recently, though, obviously, been doing a third party risk space in the last 6 years and. Wrote a book a couple of years ago that you and I've talked about a couple times on LinkedIn about called Cybersecurity and Third-Party Risk. Again, sort of my take and best practices, and has become a bit of a guidebook in the space, which is really comforting to see as a content producer. And then worked with Third-Party Risk Association, which is a not-for-profit for practitioners, to create kind of first of its kind third-party training for how to best practices again on for cyber assessors in the third party space. And then this latest book called and I joke about it because I'm not the very most inventive on software on book titles, but it's called Zero Trust and Third Party Risk. So the joke is the over under in Vegas is that Greg's next book will be something and third party risk. But yeah, that's where it was. And this latest book I'm really excited about because I believe it addresses some of the core sort of risks in the space and how we can address them. But I know we have questions pending, so I'll hold my fire.
Yeah, definitely. You know, you've been kind of beating the drum of third-party risk management for quite a while. And, you know, and we've seen the, you know, obviously it's not a new practice per se, but we've seen a lot of activity in the last several years, right. In particular, like in the defense space with the evolution of CMMC and, you know, the defense industrial base. And then obviously software supply chain security has been a critical topic in the open source community, as well as proprietary software, cloud service providers, managed service providers, everything in between when it comes to third-party risk management. So this latest book, you know, like you said, you kind of brought together Zero Trust and Third-Party Risk Management. Can you tell us a bit about the book? You know, what made you go down this path and you know, how you see the convergence of ZT and third-party risk?
Yeah, it's I hope it's a great story. I was going to say it's a great story, but some may argue with that. I was last year at IC Squared's Security Congress and talking about my first book again. The secondary title for that first book was called Third Party Threat Hunting, and that was a play at how. And you said this is not new, right? Banks have been doing this since OCC came out with the guidance in 2014. Again, I'm probably somebody's going to check me on that, but it's been a while. And what happens when regulators get engaged is we go into compliance mode because we just want to get third and fourth line off our backs often. And compliance and security are often conflated, but as you and I both know and have preached, they are not the same. So I was at IC Squared Congress, and I one of the benefits of speaking, and I always encourage folks to do speaking at these if they have something to share, is you get a free ticket to see the other speakers. And so I get to go learn. So I sat in on George Finney's talk about his book, Project Zero Trust, which is a great book. I highly recommend it if you're trying to figure out how to get into zero trust space as a leader. He had put together what he borrowed the OSI table and put together a table that explained how to approach zero trust from an enterprise perspective. And I saw that table in his speech and his presentation. I had sort of that, you know, a brick fell on my head. Oh, okay, now I get it. I can put, because I had been struggling with, and one of the premises of this book is that you're mathematically inevitable to have a breach of the third party at this point, right? And the statistics prove it. 98% of companies report that they've had a third party incident affect them in the last 2 years. 98%. I mean, that's 100%. I mean, that's the other 2% probably just didn't report it. Let's be honest, right? So everybody's been affected. You're mathematically inevitable. So if it's going to happen, it's not a question of when anymore, but it's going to happen. And sometimes it happens multiple times in a year for some companies. If you have thousands of vendors, the best way to approach it is just say, look, I'm gonna get hit. I need to figure out a way to reduce the impact. Again, reduce the blast radius is the secondary title on the second book, is for a reason, right? You're going to get impacted. So let's figure out a way to protect, you know, zero trust principles, you know, define your protect surface, map your transaction flows, your traffic flows, architect it, create the policies, and then implement, monitor, and maintain. And that's a linear process, not a circular process. Then you go to the next protect surface and start down that process. So that's where I got the idea from. I'll give George the complete credit for it. And in fact, that's why he wrote the foreword. And if you don't read the book, just read the foreword, because George is a great writer. And I really cracked up at his, he does like a Kung Fu reference and stuff. It's hilarious. So it's a really good reference.
Yeah, definitely a fan of that book. For folks who haven't heard of it, you know, Project Zero Trust, it kind of reads, if you've read things like The Phoenix Project or other kind of novel-based, you know, tech books, it makes it enjoyable to read, but also gets across the principles of zero trust and like gives you a scenario-based, you know, fictional scenario of like how it could play out in an enterprise environment. So check it out. I want to actually dig in on something. You use the term, you know, protect surface. And for folks that don't know, you know, we often talk about attack surface, but we end up kind of chasing all the things all the time, everywhere. What's the difference with a protect surface, and how do we approach that from third party risk management perspective? Right.
Yeah, you know, the best visualization I can give for protect surface is the one that I actually had the pleasure of spending a few minutes on the phone with John Kindervagas when I was writing this book. He gave me some feedback. And you know, this is a book that required me to learn quite a bit, right? Zero trust is a multidiscipline approach, right? It's not third party. You're taking expertise from across your enterprise and really leveraging it, right? So the best way I can explain it would be with the presidential motorcade. Okay, so we've all seen the U.S. presidential motorcade, and you have the beast going down, right? That's the protect surface, right? It's protecting the first family. That's the most important piece of this presidential motorcade, right? Then you have the Secret Service agents. Those are the monitoring and controls in your space. They're looking around. And if you watch the motorcade, they're not just looking forward, right? They're looking everywhere, right? So that's the reference to, you know, John Kindervag used the term no more crunchy centers. And he said, hey, you know, we view our networks like M&Ms. That we have a, you know, kind of crunchy exterior you have to get through, and then that delicious, chewy interior chocolate, right? And once you get past that, both the controls to get past it and as well as the monitoring are all on the outside. So you get that soft, gooey interior, right? So the motorcade is going down, right? And you have the ingress, egress points for sort of those, you generally the barriers that you have across the streets, right? And you have everybody plastered up against that, right? So if there's an attack on the presidential motorcade, and obviously that's not something I want to visualize in current environment, but just as an example for your enterprise, when it's attacked, right, the protect surface in the beast is the primary focus, right? And so and including the cars before and behind it, right, before the presidential beast. So if it's attacked, God forbid it would happen that some of those folks that are around it, that are monitoring and controlling it, would be affected, right? And there are service members along that. And while we certainly value, and I'm a former service member, I think you are as well, Chris, that, you know, we value the service members, they possibly could be injured or lose their lives. But if the motorcade gets away and the president and his first family are unscathed, then the protect surface met its goal. The analogy in our enterprise space would be that's your customer database with credit cards in it, right? That's your protect surface around it. And you're not having to protect everything in your enterprise anymore. You're focused on the most valuable artifacts that you have, the most valuable items you have. And let's say, again, not to diminish service members, but let's say the service members are your intranet, right? The intranet's important for your operations, but it probably doesn't contain confidential information. It probably shouldn't. Let's put it that way. So you protect your customer database. So when the hackers get in, and again, this is a question of if, not when, or a question of when, not if. I'm sorry, I had it backwards. God forbid they hack at your intranet. Unfortunate, you could probably get some backup tapes and probably get to that point where you need it to be. But you don't want to have to recover your customer database because you're not going to be able to recover it because the hackers have it, right? So this is the point, and I think it's the best visualization. Hopefully I didn't go on too long, Chris.
No, not at all. I like the kind of the scenario to kind of demonstrate the concept. And also I like this paradigm shift because, you know, as we know in security, there's never enough time and resources to protect all the things and do all the things we need to do. So starting with the crown jewels, and, you know, typically this will kind of be done doing like business impact analysis or identifying your mission essential functions or your most critical systems or most sensitive data and kind of starting to prioritize from there outward. So I think that's a great practical example. One thing I wanted to ask you about too is, like I talked about, we've seen a lot of focus lately around software supply chain security. And then obviously cybersecurity supply chain risk management. How do you see the two interplaying? Is, you know, software supply chain security a subset of third-party risk management or CSCRM? And then how do you kind of mature two of those programs in the enterprise at the same time?
So it is kind of two sides of the same coin a little bit, right? I mean, you could get into parsing the word a little bit or the definitions. I think they have the same goal ultimately, right? Which is a secure and stable software supply chain. Your own book talks about it, right, Chris? And in a software-driven society, I think 90% of the work that comes across any TPRM's desk these days is probably a SaaS product or software-driven product because we just don't get that much hardware as much as we used to. It's still there, but I think the ultimate goal for all of us is to identify the risks and then try to figure out other ways to mitigate them or remove them, right? Risk never being zero. On the software supply chain, you know, having worked at Cisco and worked in the security development space, and again, you know, they deliver hardware, but they still deliver software. You know, the focus was on things like threat modeling and ensuring that you have a co-development process that really ensures that you're looking at, you know, all the things, static and dynamic testing, right? Input validation, all the best practices that folks like you and Chris Romeo and others that in the space talk about ad nauseum, that like I talk about third-party risk that we still are kind of trying to get through people and get through new converts. So I don't have a pat answer as much as I think, but again, both are trying to accomplish the same goal. And the wordsmithing for me is probably less important than focused on kind of where we want to focus the cart.
Yeah, I like that answer. I agree. It's it's definitely quite a convergence between the two, but there's some nuanced differences too. You know, you could be talking about a supplier having access to a facility or systems, you know, maybe not delivering software, but just having access to your environment or storing your data, you know, those kind of things. And so I wanted to ask you as well, you know, anyone who's done, you know, third-party risk management, you threw out the term SaaS, for example, we're all likely painfully familiar with lengthy, you know, questionnaires, several hundred of questions you get sometimes in a paper-based kind of questionnaire type model. What are your thoughts on where we see things going? Like there's been a push lately for machine-readable attestations and automation and trying to automate, you know, control assessments and cloud environments and things like that. You know, where do you see us heading? Do you see, like, you know, the paper-based kind of questionnaire always being having a part, or, you know, where do you see things going in the future as we try to scale up these programs?
Unfortunately, yes. And the reason why is because we'll always have that low tech need for some vendors and some organizations, right? They just won't be at that place where we can automatically have some of this stuff done. That being said, I'm really opinionated now on the length of these questionnaires, and I'm not going to hold back on it. A SIG Lite at 400 questions is not light. That's an insane number of questions that I joke at. I have friends that shared assessments. I'm not trying to pick on them. I'm just saying it's not a light questionnaire, right? And shared assessments is not alone in this space, right? Almost all the questionnaires from the consortiums like KWA3P and others are insanely long. And I just question whether or not you're actually getting valuable data, how much time the vendor is actually spending to answer the data correctly. Because, look, just put yourself in a vendor's shoes, which isn't hard because all of us generally get these questionnaires because we're all vendors for somebody else. But, you know, you fill out an online form, and after the 10th or 15th question, you're like, I'm already thinking about what I'm having for dinner. Why am I answering 500 questions? The other concern I have is on the flip side, and this goes toward like things like SBOM, by the way, too. We have to consume all this data, and we already have a lot of data that I don't believe we really are acting on and consuming in a proper way. And the regulators, again, I'm not a big fan of gearing your program for the regulators. I think if you gear a program towards cybersecurity principles on the cybersecurity side, the regulators will still be happy because you'll accomplish what they're going for. But I don't understand why when we focus on my train of thought, Chris, remind me where we were going with this question.
Yeah, we were talking about the kind of the legacy, a traditional way of doing paper-based compliance questionnaires, and how they always have a place, you know, for example.
So as the place matures, as this space matures, you will see things like AI and machine learning, and we're already seeing this come to bear where we can leverage that to answer the questionnaires. Or actually, the biggest issue really is your vendor has their program in one format, you have yours and how you want to get in another format. We spend time trying to figure out how to make the two connect, right? So the AI, again, used correctly and all the other caveats we all use is this can help with that sort of manual correlation. It's really not a good use of human time, right? And then the human can get engaged with, oh, this one didn't, this one I couldn't make fit. I don't understand why they answered peanut butter and jelly sandwich when I was asking for bologna, right? So again, that's where you can really, and we're all struggling with resources, both on the vendor side and the organizational side. So we're going to have to look for automation and workflow. I really believe that we need to get to a place where we're looking at not how much a vendor has of your data necessarily, all that stuff, what the risk of the vendor is to your organization. That's a, I think, a much more active approach, and it gets towards a third-party threatening approach. On the questionnaire side, I think we should have 75 questions to 100 questions at most, and focus in on your critical controls. And those are hard for us to define, Chris, right? Those are encryption, MFA for privileged access, logging and monitoring everywhere. You know, those kind of things, right? So I think if you narrow it down and focus in on things that are really critical for security, and they're doing those things well, likely they're doing the other things really, really okay. What we typically find is, and you've probably seen this too, Chris, is if they're not doing basic table stakes stuff very well, then the other stuff is falling down too, right? If they can't do the basics.
Yeah, I think you're spot on. You said a few things that I wanted to pull the thread on is like there's a churn and a kind of a tax that gets imposed on both parties. On the supplier side, you know, they have to continually provide these artifacts to the customer or consumer, often in different formats or different, you know, different questions that need to be answered. And they try to, like, you know, kind of pre-can these and templatize them and, you know, reproduce them for different customers, but it's never typically a one-to-one match. And then on the consumer side, it's great that you're asking all these things, but are you actually even reviewing all this information? Do you even have the bandwidth to review it all? And what are you doing to actually drive down organizational risk with all the information too? So I think that, you know, getting down to those critical controls is important, and then leaning into automation, AI, and other things that are emerging, like you talked about, is going to be key. But of course, you know, everyone has a different definition of what critical is. So that's opening up another can of worms, you know. So there's definitely that to be said.
Go ahead. Can I pull on that thread just a little bit? Mm-hmm. So if you're struggling for what a critical control is, look at the executive orders that have come out in that space. There's some good direction like that. I'm not one to necessarily lean on regulators to define my program. If you're in the financial space, for example, look at NYDFS 500 Part 11. It acutely describes what they view as critical controls. They pretty much mirror what you and I would consider critical controls as well. So there is a way that you can get guidance, but you're right. It will vary by infrastructure and by business and all that kind of stuff. That's a great point.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. And you know, a plug for the resource you named, as well as like things like CIS top, 20 critical controls, or I think it might be 18 now, those kind of things for sure. So I wanted to ask you, you used the phrase a second ago, you said we're all someone else's supplier too. And it kind of speaks to this complex interdependent, ecosystem that we have where we're all consuming things, but we're also supplying services or software, et cetera, to other organizations as well, or other entities within the organization in some cases. Some people kind of consider third-party risk management to be a bit of a Gordian knot type issue in the sense that, we talked about things like encryption and logging and monitoring and so on. Large organizations, in my experience, struggle to even get a handle on that themselves, let alone go out and validate that their suppliers are doing those things well. How does the organization typically get started successfully of just getting a handle on the landscape?
And by the way, it's not an unusual conversation I'll have with folks who are focused on first party security, right? Which is your organizations, right? So, and it is a challenge if you're like the folks in cyber ops and stuff. They're very focused in and as they should be on your first party. And when I have a conversation with how do you ask somebody else what they're doing? I mean, that just sounds crazy, Greg. What are you doing? So the best way to start is actually look at your is always a risk-based approach. And again, if you're a first-party person, mostly you're a third party, look at how you attack your vulnerability management programs, right? We never attack those as a one-size-fits-all or a boil-the-ocean approach, right? We always attack those from a risk-based approach. So the same thing in this case. I use the word systemically critical vendors. These are the vendors that your organization requires to keep their lights on, right? And so if they fall, you fall. That's the best place to start, right? Because if you can secure and stabilize those vendors, then you're able to operate as a business. And now you can start to spread your net out further to, if you're big enough, maybe you have lines of business that have their own critical vendors, right? And so you can go down the list and you can expand that universe as you get a hold of the most critical ones first, high risk, medium risk, and then low risk, right? And you would pay appropriate attention as the risk chain went down, right? Of course, the first step in any of this is to figure out what your risk appetite is. But I'm assuming that most organizations have done that. The other key I would say that I've learned in recent years that I see a lot of organizations kind of struggling with is these need to be enterprise risks, right? A third-party risk is still an enterprise risk, okay? So don't put it in a special bucket that this is somebody else's risk. This risk is now inherited and owned by you because it's that third party is an extension of your own enterprise, right? Whether you like it or not, that's the way it's evolved. And so if they have a lot of your data, that's your customer's data or your employee's data. And you should treat it as it's outside my environment. I need to understand how they're doing their best to encrypt it, protect it, make sure it's logged and monitored.
Yeah, I like what you emphasize there in terms of, your customers' data, because as we know, there's regulatory or legal ramifications or even reputational and revenue ramifications or implications for not doing that as well. One thing you talked about is we talked about asking people questions, asking your suppliers questions or providing questionnaires and things like that. And I wanted to kind of get your thoughts on another age old debate, which is like kind of first party self-attestation versus third party attestation. And the reason I ask that is I've worked in, different environments where I've had FedRAMP where we have a third party. It's a lot more rigorous, but it's also more costly and more cumbersome and more time consuming. Right. And then you have first party self-attestation, which is maybe a little bit easier and faster. But when there's revenue on the line, maybe you don't get the most truthful answers, or maybe you don't get the most rigorous information, for example.
So same thing, Chris, right? Yeah, right. Okay, so there's not all third-party attestations are created equal, right? And what I mean by that is, let's give you an example, the FedRAMP, which I'm familiar with, having worked at Cisco, is a great program, and it's very rigorous to get into it. And so if a vendor comes along for you and says, and they're a cloud-based vendor, and they say, we have a FedRAMP medium, it's perfectly reasonable and regulators are okay with this and your program can account for it as long as you've got it written down, that you accept certain other attestations in lieu of your own due diligence work. So in this case, let's say a vendor comes along and says, I have a FedRAMP medium, Greg, and we're offering you a SaaS product. I wouldn't necessarily need to assess the security in their cloud environment because somebody's already done that for me and given them a very good clean bill of health, right? But I would still potentially investigate if they're in a, if they're a critical vendor, their enterprise, right? Stuff outside the cloud to see how there's no ability to traverse into back into the their internal network and all that stuff, right? And then I, what I would do is say, as we look at, let me bring up another point that I think that we sometimes miss, and it's a little off topic, but is the physical validation piece in this piece, right? I see a lot of organizations still not doing this after COVID. I think your most critical vendors are ones that you should be physically, so this is to your first part attestation, you should be going to and physically validating, right? It's the difference between asking your kid, is your room clean? And you going as a parent, and you're getting this, Chris, right away, you ain't going to check if the room is clean, right? It's not that the kid is lying. Their definition of clean is just different than yours, right? And I have a 17-year-old son, and his definition of clean in his room is way different than mine. And that's okay. I go in and, the dish on the, that's supposed to be down in the sink, you know? So again, you know, physical attestation, and that's the first party. But the reference to not all third-party associations are created equal is a reference to SOC 2 Type 2 reports. I have a personal love-hate relationship with these. They can be very valuable if you understand how to read them, if you understand scope of what was done. And I also caution some folks, I'm going to get some hate mail on this. You can direct it to greg@rasmer.com. But the fact is that there are some boutique audit firms, I think, who get too friendly with the customer in this case. And I question the findings that they attest to, right? The bigger national and locally recognized firms, they understand that their reputation's at stake and they don't do this. So I'm not calling out every firm at doing this. But I've been in physical validation exercises with vendors where they have a SOC 2 Type 2 that says they got a clean bill of health. And I swear to gosh, Stevie Wonder must have done the SOC 2 Type 2 because there's no way that they saw what I saw. It just isn't physically possible. So again, I think you have to be careful about what you take in as a third-party attestation. They're perfectly reasonable to take if you understand the background and the organization that's doing it. Another way to approach this, I've heard, and hopefully I can take the time to do this, is tell folks that what you can do is you can actually pre-select third-party attestations that you'll accept, right? Or from vendors that you'll accept. Like, let's say on a SOC 2 Type 2 type of problem, right? Let's say you say, hey, vendors will take SOC 2 Type 2s from these organizations, these audit firms, without question. The other ones, if you take somebody else, it's not that we won't take it. We just may give you a little bit more of a hard time if you do it outside of this. We're not endorsing these firms. We just know that these firms produce quality SOC 2 Type 2s, and you could use those for this, and we won't give you a second thought about it. We'll accept it as long as the scope and everything's correct, right? Does that help, Chris?
Yeah, no, it does. And I was actually going to kind of, pull the thread on a couple of things you said is you kind of pulled the curtain behind a little bit of an icky part of our ecosystem in the sense that sometimes the firms that are being assessed are the ones selecting and paying the assessor. And there's a bit of a conflict of interest at play there, because they're incentivized to like provide favorable work or not get selected again in the future. And then there's also some challenges around some of the larger, more successful, assessment firms may also be a bit more expensive and things like that. So you may be, maybe if you're a small startup, you're trying to save capital or whatever the case is.
You might go with more.
So it's definitely, a very difficult dichotomy we have in our ecosystem. So I wanted to ask you as well, like as we see zero trust, and third-party risk management converge here in this book that you have, a lot of organizations are making down the path of zero trust and trying to get an assessment of where they stand on zero trust on their journey and mapping the things like, CISA zero trust maturity model and other things like that. But zero trust is a bit of a misnomer in the sense that there's not no trust, it's just not implicit trust. But when we look at supply chains, there is some level of implicit trust in your suppliers. You're kind of trusting them to some extent. As we look at these two topics, moving forward, and maybe a sneak peek of the book, what can folks learn about these two topics and how they interplay with one another?
Sure. Yeah, and the zero trust is a buzzword, right? That's been probably overused. And as I say in the book and in my presentations on the book, it's not a technology, it's not a tool. The vendor's not going to solve this for you. Like third party risk, And like a lot of stuff we do in this, it's a program and a process that you implement, that you use tools and technologies to produce a strategy outcome, right? So what I call for in the book, and what I think folks need to get their head around it too, is that you need a strategy, right? It's not enough to just say, I'm coming every day and doing cybersecurity. What is your grand strategy? If your grand strategy is to protect customer data, then the next step to doing that would be to understand how you're going to protect that data. And if a breach is inevitable, which it, again, a third-party breach is inevitable by the very statistics we talked about, then zero trust is the best strategy, at least to reduce the impact of that breach. I heard somebody recently say that, and I was at I've been at a couple conferences speaking recently on the book and other topics, they didn't like the zero trust moniker either, because it isn't really, like you said, zero trust. They call the word trust assurance. And what they are intending by that was, to your point, you know, John Kindervag's point in zero trust was that we're overly trusting right now. Like, once you get past the M&M's crunchy exterior, we don't ask you anything anymore, right? And we don't even look at what you're doing, right? So it's the equivalent of having a guest come into your corporate headquarters. You badge them in yourself, and then you let them walk around the headquarters unescorted. Nobody would do that in their right minds in most organizations these days, but that's exactly what we do in networks, right? We just let the stranger walk around unmolested. So what I would say is, look at your network and to see, do you have the crunchy exterior M&M model, or do you have a model that's actually looking at what's going on internally to your network? Most of us, unfortunately, still have the crunchy exterior model, because to do the zero trust model, and again, the moniker is a little silly sometimes for folks because there is implicit trust, is you're checking and validating things like identity and context on a continual basis, on a near continual basis, right? That's the biggest difference, I think, from current infrastructure to new infrastructure in ZT. There's others, right? I don't want hate mail from ZT lovers that say that, hey, you missed this point. I get it. But that's the biggest difference for us, I think, in this space, is that you're checking identity and validating with strong authentication, right? And you're continually checking it along the way, right? So if Greg logs in with two-factor authentication, but Greg logs in from Shanghai, that's a problem. That's not really Greg, because Greg can't time warp like that or move space and time like that. If I could, I wouldn't be doing this right now. So again, you know, there's a lot more context-aware space that we need to expand in most networks. So that's the context, right? It's not just that Greg MFA'd into the network, but he's past his geofence. Greg doesn't travel outside the U.S. typically, right? He's not notified us he's doing that. So I'm not going to let this Greg in, because it's not really Greg. Right. That's the biggest difference I think we'll see with zero trust if you can implement it correctly. The table that we talk about, and it's in the book, and I'm sorry I don't have it to share it. I think you could search for it. I probably have it somewhere up on one of my because the table itself isn't super secret. But it breaks it down so that you can understand, like, for zero trust third party infrastructure, what are you going to be doing on each of those pieces? Like, you're going to be monitoring all your IoT infrastructure, right? You're going to be making sure that any of the authentication that's happening from the IoT device has least privileges. How many times, Chris, in your life have you asked? You've looked at a login and go, that's not least privilege. Somebody gave that user a super user because they were just, it was just easier. We have to stop pushing the easy button. Right.
Yeah, I personally like the convergence that you've done here with zero trust and third-party risk management, because you know, these fundamental principles that organizations are starting to look internally and kind of do this introspection of segmentation, for example, and limiting the blast radius and least permissive access and continuous monitoring, things that are being evaluated from a zero trust perspective, applying that to your third parties is a critical thing to do, so that if there is, and there will be, as we've discussed, a breach of your third party, for example, your suppliers, you kind of minimize the impact on your organization, which I think is the key theme of the book. And definitely, folks, check out the book. I put it up here on the screen here for folks to go check it out. So last question for you, Greg, is what does the term cyber resiliency mean to you?
Wow. There's three legs right on the triad, right? And availability is one that I think we just sometimes ignore at our peril, right? And I'm a big proponent of cyber resiliency. To me, it means that you're focused on the ability, that you're focused not just if a breach happens, but when a breach happens, you're able to continue operating, whether that's selling to customers, operating your internal network, whatever it is that your operation needs to do to keep the lights on and function, that you've thought about that, right? We often, I think, assume that the infrastructure we have is resilient, and I challenge a lot of us to rethink that process, because this environment is only going to get messier. The geopolitical landscape is going to get even worse for us in some ways, and that will drive more cyber activity, and that will drive our ability to be resilient or inability to be resilient. So I challenge most organizations to lean into that cyber resiliency and the things that you've been talking about, because it is critically important for us. We will get attacked. We will get events and incidents. We need to understand how we can get past them.
Yeah, great answer. I think I'm in agreement with you. When we look at, there's another good book called The Fifth Domain. It talks about kind of the convergence of cybersecurity into, warfare and, our critical infrastructure and the things that you're talking about, the geopolitical climate. I think things are only going to get more interesting from here, better or worse.
That's one way to put it, isn't it?
So for folks that want to follow you and learn more about, the book and what you're up to, your speaking engagements, where can folks find you?
Yeah, well, LinkedIn is a decent place. Of course, that's where you and I connected, and it's been where I've connected with a lot of folks. www.thirdpartythreathunting.com or reducetheblastradius.com. As you can tell, I take the second titles and then go book those URLs pretty quickly so I can communicate with readers. So feel free. Oh, and by the way, it is available on Amazon, but right now on Wiley for the Cyber Awareness Month, they're giving a 35% discount on the book, on the print copy, not the e-reader. And so I think it's CYB35 is the code you put in at checkout at Wiley, and you get a 35% discount. And there's also going to be an audio version of the book coming out on Amazon. I think you can get pre-order that one already. And it's not me reading it; it's a professional voice reader. So you won't have to listen to my mouth breathing for 3 hours.
Very cool. Well, thank you so much for taking the time to chat with us. And thanks to everyone that tuned in today. I hope everyone has a great weekend. Take care.
Thanks a lot. Cheers, everybody.